All right, good evening. So this night we'll continue the exploration into wise effort. Wise effort. Now, effort's one of those words that we have some relationship with already. We apply effort in our work, in our relationships, in our, you know, maybe with working with our bodies, in our homes. We're used to applying effort in some way, so it's not a neutral term that we just can slip right into in the Dharma practice. In fact, we carry a default relationship to effort. You know, what it means to us, how we apply our will, how we apply will to try to get something for ourselves, you know, change ourselves, whatever it might be. And so this is what we've explored the last couple weeks, is what this default relationship to effort is. The reason for that is to try to clear out the unconsciousness around it. Because if we're not conscious of our background, attitude, and relationship with effort, it naturally starts to seep in to our practice. Sometimes in very overt, very strong ways, sometimes more and more subtle ways. The trouble is that often the way we use effort has the seeds of our suffering embedded in it. Okay, the very mechanism for our suffering is kind of stuck into that middle of efforting, into that sense of willpower, of trying to overcome ourselves, to make ourselves into something better. All of these assume that there's a self that needs to change, a self that needs to evolve. There's often a strategy too that my life would be much better if I had X, Y, and Z. You know, whatever that might be, a relationship, a job, a car, a house, whatever it might be, that sense of if I apply my effort, then I'll be happy. So this is kind of really embedded in our normal way of trying to solve this problem, this fundamental problem of being not quite right in the world, not quite happy, not quite at peace. You know, the way we're brought up, the way we're conditioned, is that by applying effort, we can be happier. Certainly there is a level of that. But that happiness is limited. It's based on circumstances and conditions which change, which alter. And the happiness that the Buddha talked, the happiness that we seek as Dharma practitioners is not dependent upon the circumstances, the situation of our life. It's a much more fundamental way of relating to ourselves and the world. And so if we don't examine how effort has been conditioned in our minds and our hearts, it tends to seep into our practice. And it causes a way of perpetuating that suffering, even the very practice which is designed to liberate us from that suffering. So especially if you read the suttas and the actual technical definition of right effort is applying, or a monk or a nun generates desire, endeavors, activates persistence, upholds and exerts her or his intent. Okay, so this sounds very much effortful. The non-arising of unwholesome, unskillful qualities that have not yet abandoned, the abandonment of unwholesome, unskillful qualities that have arisen, the rising of wholesome, skillful qualities that have not yet arisen, and the maintenance, non-confusion, increase, plenitude, development, and culmination of wholesome, skillful qualities that have arisen. Okay, so that's quite a mouthful. There's a lot of little technical pieces. And so, but the important thing is that part about efforting, it's easy to hear that without realizing that the wise part of that effort means it's really embedded in the noble truths, as we've talked about again and again. Now, as I look at that list to try to make it a little bit more manageable, one thing that comes to mind is this quality of discernment. The ability to see, is something really wholesome? Is something not wholesome? You know, can see if something has arisen or not arisen, or perhaps is about to arise. So this is this sense of effort. It's not just this blind effort. It's a sense of clear seeing, a clear discernment about how the state of mind actually is. This simple discernment, simple way to look at it is, does something lead toward suffering or does it lead to freedom from suffering? And the Buddha was very clear that this is just the, these two lines of action, lines of effort, lines of engagement. Often our normal way leads and perpetuates our suffering. The Dharma practice is going in the direction that reduces that suffering, that leads to the end of that suffering. There's a famous sutta called the Two Kinds of Thought that maybe we'll talk about in the next year or so. When the Buddha talked about, before he became enlightened, kind of how his practice was. And some of those suttas are really interesting to see. He says, okay, back before I became awakened, this is how I was practicing. In other words, this is what worked for me to liberate my mind, to liberate my heart. And he very simply realized that some courses of action, some courses of thought were embedded in greed, hatred, and delusion. And as he watched, those led to suffering in himself and in others. So he observed that. While other types of actions, you know, based in kindness and non-harm and renunciation, led to the unbinding of the heart, led to the lack of affliction in himself and others. And he just said, well, why not just focus on the ones that lead to liberation and release the ones that don't? This is the essence of wise effort, discerns what leads to suffering and what doesn't. And then where do we put our energy? And how do we actually apply our energy? So we can look at that from a kind of a almost microscopic way of how do we meet each moment when we're sitting in silent meditation? How do we meet this breath, this contraction of mind? We can also look at it in our daily life, how we are with others, with our work, with our families, with our friends, with strangers. This is a constant ground for practice also. Now, discernment is often learned through trial and error. There's a quote that, what is it, good wisdom comes from experience. No, good judgment comes from experience, and experience comes from bad judgment. You know, so we make mistakes. We err, we overcompensate, we do all these things. And if we pay attention, we start to learn from that. As is said well in this autobiography in 5 short chapters by Porta Nelson. So chapter 1, I walk down the street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I am lost. I am helpless. It isn't my fault. It takes me forever to find a way out. Chapter 2, I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend I don't see it. I fall in again. I can't believe I'm in the same place, but it isn't my fault. Still, it still takes a long time to get out. Chapter 3, I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see it is there. I still fall in. It's a habit. My eyes are open. I know where I am. It is my fault. I get out immediately. Chapter 4. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I walk around it. Chapter 5. I walk down another street. So this is a very kind of clear description of how we often learn discernment in our practice. We learn it through falling in those holes. And often those holes are kind of, they're blind to us. We don't realize that they're there. So these shows up in our patterns of reactivity, patterns of harshness, of self-judgment, external judgment. All these different patterns that we struggle with. You know, these are common things that we tend to repeat again and again. And we say, why do I keep choosing that same type of person for relationships? Why do I keep not being able to do this and that? It's that these common holes come in. And there's a sense of denial, of not seeing. And as we start to practice, we cultivate the capacity to see clearly. And in that clear seeing, we start to see, oh, I'm in this hole. I fell into this. It's a familiar hole. And the discernment starts to see, okay, where is those holes? And we start to have that choice of not to fall in them, to even walk down a different street. This is that two kinds of thought, going toward liberation, going toward suffering. So this process of wise effort brings this capacity of choice. But if we don't have a choice, we can't discern, we can't see clearly. And realistically, the sense of discernment and that really the accuracy of it grows over time. Grows as we practice, as we gain insights, as we gain more clarity, as our sense of compassion toward ourselves and toward others becomes more and more foundational in our lives, that sense of discernment also grows. So often we get so confused by, you know, the story in our mind and the worries and all the history of things. And we start to learn to trust that inner stillness, that inner small quiet voice that has that clarity, has that sense of wisdom. This is the sense of discernment. So this wise effort has to have that quality of discernment, and often also has to have this quality of being able to see with a perspective, a sense of seeing the big picture or the process, a sense of almost stepping back a little bit to see the whole, to see the current of things. You know, if you've ever been in a big crowd, like I remember, you know, that first inaugural march, you know, the women's march. So I was marching with my wife and daughter. And, you know, at one point we kind of stepped out to try to, you know, catch up with some people. And instead of being in the midst of everyone moving, you're standing and you're watching this whole stream of people go by. And you get a sense of the energy and the momentum and the intention behind that. And so too, when we're in our lives, when we feel that sense of rub and struggle, or just even being engaged with life in a very joyful way, wise effort has to have a sense of stepping back a little bit to see what is the current I'm swimming in, what's the stream I'm swimming in, what's the culture, what's the environment. Because if we stay locked in it, we stay in participating in it without realizing it is part of a whole thing, we lose that capacity for discernment, the capacity for wise effort. Because likely or not, our default, both of our own minds and hearts, the default of our culture, really of humans, you could almost say, is to go toward a way that leads toward suffering. We'll talk a little bit more about that deep mechanism. That deep mechanism, and really the kind of the core question around discernment, is does this activity, this relationship with the moment's experience, the way I'm being mindful, the way I'm practicing, does it reinforce the sense of self? Does it reinforce the sense of isolation, of separation? Or does it lead to questioning that? To starting to soften that, to dissolve it, to actually see through it, to see that it's just another thought that has been believed in. Now, the sense of self is often a very talked about, but also some perhaps an elusive quality to get a hold of, to get a sense of. I mean, just think about today's, how you were in today. Maybe you woke up and you felt a little cranky, and then later on you felt a little happy when you heard some good news, and then you had a good lunch, and then you had a fight with someone, and then each of those states you had a different way of feeling. I was happy, I was sad, I was cranky. You could say it in a different way. You could say, I had a sense of self that was cranky. I had a sense of self that was happy. A sense of self that was angry. And really what's happening is this sense of me-ness kind of forms, kind of constructs from the inside out based on interactions, based on conditions. And that formation is really based on the momentum of our history, of what we've believed in, how we have acted, that tends to make those channels go a certain way. Like a train track, you know, a train gets switched this way, and then it goes that way, and then it goes this other way. But there's this energy, this momentum that goes down that. This is how we live our life, if you look carefully. And part of the Dharma practice, a key, perhaps the most key part, is to start to see that that is a construct. That is something that we're believing in and forming around. And this becomes really the heart of wise effort, to see really in a clear way what leads to more contraction, more reinforcing of this sense of self, versus what leads to the release of that sense of self. This is really the train of the second noble truth, really the origination of suffering. Is the sense of self. When you get down to the tanha, the very technical pieces of the 12-step dependent origination, which we won't go into, but that is a very technical way to see how suffering is created, how the sense of self arises based on past conditions, contact with the moment's experience, movement towards something, into a quality of clinging and craving to becoming, okay, here I am. And then that sense of self eventually fades, and then there's suffering from that. Now, until you start to see chinks in that, you start to see gaps in that sense of self, until it starts to dissolve, sometimes little hints of it, sometimes much more dramatic qualities, it's often a very abstract concept. And so sometimes it's good to just hear it and kind of listen for it in your own practice. But we can still get a very strong handle on wise effort without that sense of self being such a clarity of our practice and our understanding. And that's in the quality of suffering in our lives, the quality of friction, of rub, of distress, dis-ease. Because when that's operating, if you look closely, there's a quality of self that's embedded in that. So we can start to apply wise effort into those areas. And then the practice is naturally starting to lead in the right direction, in a helpful direction. The sense of suffering and the sense of self are very interrelated. In fact, they're very independent. You can almost say they're one and the same. Since the self arises, then suffering will arise at some point. You know, sometimes it's not so obvious that's connected. We can kind of look at, there's two kinds of suffering that generally arise with this sense of self. There's a suffering that happens when we're upset, when we're worried, when we're anxious, when we're fearful, sad. You know, that quality of self is painful. And the pain of it is connected with how much we believe it, how much we take it to be, this is about me. It's very gripping. This is who I am. You know, we're lamenting about how much pain. And, you know, not to minimize how painful that can be. You know, when we really feel triggered by something, when we really feel upset, it really feels so personal, feels so gripping. You know, or we feel very righteous in our anger around something. Or if you look closely, it's really that sense of self that's really firmly embedded in that. That's why I tend to emphasize in my own practice and in my own teaching the investigation of that grippingness of that sense of self. And how we get triggered when we get emotionally charged by something is actually, if you look at it in a helpful way, in a right way, it's a guidepost. It's a set of lines pointing back to that sense of self. So if you follow it in the right way, you can actually start to dissolve that. You can actually see that is not true. It's not who you are. Doesn't mean you don't still get angry. Doesn't mean you still don't get fearful or sad. It just is not so tied back into who you think you are. It's not so tied back into the sense of self. So it's much more of this wave that's moving through the system. That you're angry, you're upset, and then it falls away. You're able to meet the next moment's experience in a different way, instead of having this residue that just sticks and holds so strongly. So that's the sense of self when it's kind of the miserable sense of self. That's obvious, okay, I'm suffering in this moment. I want to try to get over that. Maybe that's what brought you to practice, is to try to get over that quality of suffering. Now the other quality of suffering with the sense of self is a little more harder to see, because that's a sense of self that we feel really happy about, that we feel really engaged. We feel like, okay, I'm really passionate, I'm really excited, I'm really happy, and I'm really, you know, loving all those qualities, a sense of joy. Sometimes it's very conditional based on, you know, our team won, or, you know, having your child succeed and or do well in school, or a sense of connecting with someone, feeling that deep quality. So the sense of self, those qualities of happiness can also happen without the self there. But usually they are kind of tied back into who I am, what I take myself to be. And so while you're feeling it, while it's present, it's wonderful. But remember that little thing called impermanence? The fact that things change. I mean, think about a time that you've been really happy, and how long has that lasted? You know, has it lasted a few weeks, or a few days, a few hours, a few moments? That the momentary happiness is wonderful, but there's also a sense of self with that. And when that situation fades and falls away, that's where the suffering comes in. It's kind of like you either get the suffering while you're having it or afterwards. It's kind of, you have to pay up at some point. So this observing the sense of self, I'm not going to go into how to do that so much in this talk, because it does take a certain intentionality, it takes a certain curiosity, and also sincerity, willingness to start to question some more fundamental root perspectives. So that sense of self, though, leaves tracks all the time. It leaves echoes from it. So we talked about the sense of suffering that is a primary marker of that. And applying wise effort when we're feeling the experience, subjective quality of suffering, can be very helpful. It can start to loosen those deeper roots without you even realizing it. And so the hindrances can actually be a good marker for when that sense of friction is arising, that sense of self is arising with the moment's experience. It's kind of like the rustle in the bushes of an unseen animal. You can't see the animal, but you hear something moving around. So when a hindrance is arising in our moment's experience, that can be a beautiful time to apply wise effort. To apply wise effort to see, you know, what leads to suffering? What leads to the release of suffering? And in doing so, we start to get some inroads into that sense of self that's often hidden behind our ignorance, behind our conditioning. Now, remembering that wise effort has this discerning quality, this quality of seeing, okay, which leads to suffering, which leads to freedom, which leads to more contraction, which leads to an ease, a sense of peace. Wise effort is also fundamentally based in wisdom and compassion. It's informed by wisdom. It's informed by compassion. Remember, it's not just effort by itself, it's wise effort. Wise effort within the context of the Eightfold Path, within the context of the Four Noble Truths. This is a pretty good definition of the wisdom factor of this tradition. And compassion is also so essential, because if we just have this sense of wisdom, it can be a little bit cutting. And the compassion starts to bring that quality of caring that there is suffering here, that there is distress. It's touching, because we're touching on very tender areas in ourselves, very tender areas in ourselves, in others, in society. And that sense of caring that there is pain here is so important, so helpful. Because we're able to really care that there is pain here, there's a way that the sense of self is softening, is releasing. And wise effort also has this capacity to step back, to see the bigger process that's here. So just going through the hindrances and seeing how wise effort can show up for that. So both in a very practical way, but also in this kind of more subtle, deeper way of working with the hindrances. So the hindrance of craving is usually the first one. So this is the one that's a little tricky because it feels good to want. It feels good to acquire something that we really find pleasurable, enjoyable. You know, so it feels like, why wouldn't I do that? You know, the person who dies with the most toys wins, right? That kind of mentality. That's kind of what is echoed in our advertisement and our culture. So this positive sense of self, okay? But when that quality of positiveness fades, when that situation fades and it's no longer there, watch for the suffering that's there. The sense of, oh, I wish that I could last longer. I wish this would be have a more sustained experience. Okay, you know, feel that sense of heaviness. You can also notice that quality of craving itself. Like if you don't have the object that you're wanting, the craving itself can actually be quite noxious if you actually tune into that. So this is where the next month of wise mindfulness comes in, that we learn this capacity to meet our moment's experience in an unflinching yet compassionate way. A way that's a stillness that meets whatever's arising. Okay, we see that sense of wanting, that sense of desire. We see the sense of lack underneath that wanting. If you follow that down, okay, what is lacking here? What's the real lack? You start to get a sense of that fundamental tanha, that thirst to become, to form. That if I have that experience, that relationship, that object, whatever it might be, then that reaffirms the sense of me. It lets me form in relationship to that. And when it's not quite formed, and we're just sitting still, we actually feel that hunger to want to become in a really, we feel how much suffering there is inherent in that. And if we use the quality of discernment, we look a little closer, we can see that object, no matter what it is, that experience, that role, that person, that will not ultimately feed that hunger. It won't actually satisfy that. It's insatiable. It's like in Buddhist cosmology, there's this realm of hungry ghosts where creatures have this really small mouth and a really large, you know, capacity for a large stomach, and they just cannot get enough food just to fill their bellies. That's often how we are. We're just often so hungry and unable to feel that satisfaction, that deep fulfillment. That's of a lasting nature. We have to be willing, we have to look in a different direction. This is the wise effort coming in. To say, okay, that pathway of seeking more and more, does that really lead to freedom? Or does it lead to more suffering? And then what does lead to freedom? What does lead to a lasting peace? So craving. Now aversion, a sense of not wanting. So again, this is a more obvious quality of suffering. You know, that our bodies are hurting, our minds are hurting, our hearts are hurting. And there's this friction with that. There's this tension around that. So again, the power of mindfulness is just be still with it. Just meet that. Try to develop a capacity to meet more and more of this quality of in ease. And we have to, you know, always watch our... we have to be honest about what that capacity actually is in us. Because sometimes we try to meet something that's really like a 10 on the scale, and our mindfulness is more at a 5 level. You know, it's gonna be overwhelming. So we learn how to make the 10 a little bit more workable or skillful ways around that. So practicing in easy ways naturally allows that capacity to grow. So aversion is this hunger to not be, to movement away. So as we're practicing, as we see it, feel hindrance arise, whether we're sitting or in interaction with someone else, start to feel that as an object in itself, as a process in itself. So the trick with both craving and aversion is the willingness to kind of suspend the object, the thing that you're focused on. I really want that zafu. I really don't want that water, right? As an example. So usually what you do, if I don't want this water, I'm going to pick it up and throw it away. I'm already doing that. Or I'm reaching to grab that zafu. So as a meditator, applying wise effort, we practice just sitting still and feeling this raw sense of wanting to move toward, wanting to push away. That's the wise effort in that moment. And there's a tremendous trust, because our normal strategy is, of course I want to get rid of this, that's going to fix the problem. But it fixed the problem temporarily. And then the next day it's the Kleenex bottle, and then it's this, and then it's that. Right? But if I learn to understand the fundamental nature of not wanting, of aversion, then I start to solve my problem more fundamentally. And then everything else in life starts to shift. So craving, aversion. Now sleepiness. Sleepiness is a very common quality that happens. And when I first started to practice, I just hated when I was sleepy. I would just struggle with it so much. I'd become very adverse to my sleepiness. Give myself a multiple hindrance attack by saying, okay, why am I sleeping? I'm trying to pay attention here. And I just would be falling asleep and fighting that and trying to be upright. But as my practice matured, I started to see, okay, bring some compassion into this. That the body is tired. The body is exhausted. You know, you're working too hard. And so there's that tenderness, that sense of compassion of what this, the fatigue may be. But there's also this interesting quality of sleepiness that's tied with delusion, tied with the sense of not seeing clearly. Right? I mean, literally, we can't keep our eyes open. We can't focus. And so sometimes working with sleepiness, you can get this sense of delusion just kind of welling up in your system. That sense of literally unconsciousness starting to become more conscious. This is one of the fundamental roots of our suffering, is this sense of delusion and not seeing clearly. So being able to step back and say, oh, sleepiness is arising, drowsiness, dullness, spaciness, lack of clarity. This is a manifestation of delusion. Observing it without acting on it, without changing it, starts to transform your relationship to it. Starts to transform its power over you. So as sleepiness arises, a sense of dullness, a sense of lack of energy, start to step out of the participating in it and just start to observe it. Like, wow, this, what does it feel like to be in this fog? What does it feel like to be unclear, to be drowsy? Wise effort applied to sleepiness. Now restlessness and worry, you know, these are such a gripping quality, especially if you look at worry in terms of anxiety. I mean, this is one of the most common things we hear as meditation teachers, is that I want meditation to help me with my anxiety, with how the mind just becomes so obsessed about worry, about terrible things that have happened, may happen. And that sense of worried mind, I was worried about a decision that's kind of looming. And I was just saying, okay, let's notice this as worry in itself. And just that simple shift of going out of participating in the storm of worry to stepping out and saying, oh, the mind is worried. The mind is anxious. Created this ability to have wise effort start to come in, to observe the state and not be caught up in the content of what I was worried about. And restlessness often comes through the body too. We just feel like we can't sit still, or perhaps we're feeling some discomfort or some pain, emotional, physical, that we can't quite sit still with. So again, that quality of compassion that this body is trying to untie and loosen up, release this pent up contraction. So wise effort in relationship to restlessness and worry often is a sense of holding it. Okay, let me just see if I can let the restlessness start to work through the system. Can I let the worry of the mind be held in a capacity that isn't caught in the details, but just feels it as an actual experience? Then finally, doubt, a sense of doubting ourselves, doubting the practice. Again, discernment comes in say, okay, is this really a good practice? Is this the right direction for me? But often doubt comes more in the sense of just confusion and not doubting our own ability, our own capacity. And so again, stepping back and saying, okay, doubt is present. That's wise effort to step back and notice that it's here. And the wise effort then, like if all these hindrances, if the willingness to just keep being present, to keep showing up, meeting moment after moment. We can start to see that wise effort is very different than our normal understanding of effort, our normal way that we use effort. It has this discernment that grows over time with clarity, with wisdom, with compassion. We start to see more and more clearly what leads to suffering, what leads to the release of suffering. As our practice unfolds and deepens, we start to see that sense of me, that sense of self as an isolated, solid thing is the root of what is wise and what is unwise. So let's just sit quietly for a few moments and let those words settle. Thank you for your kind attention. I'd like to just say a few words about the practice and reflection, and then we'll have a chance for any comments or questions, inquiries around this topic, or about anything else is fine too. So wise effort, the discernment. So this week, and maybe for the rest of your life, when you feel that sense of struggle, that sense of friction with the moment or difficulty, try to bring forth the discerning quality of mindfulness. So in other words, you start to observe the state of difficulty as a state itself and step out of the normal getting caught in the content. It's like if you were a dog chasing your tail, you just go around and around and around. But if you're able to have that dog kind of look back and see what it's doing, that's that stepping back, that sense of seeing the process. And in part of the stepping back, notice how are you meeting this experience. You know, what is your relationship to this experience? Are you really engaged in it? Are you more resistant to it? Are you really happy about it? Or, you know, what is that really that fabric of the connection, the relationship with this experience? And then ask, is this way of relating to this lead to suffering or toward peace? Does it lead to contraction? Does it lead to unbinding of the heart to more freedom? Wise effort's always going to be pointing toward more freedom, deeper and deeper freedom. And use both the formal practice, you know, sitting, you know, in a dedicated time and space, but also the informal times can be a beautiful, fruitful place to practice. So are there any comments or questions or things you'd like to explore? Yes, sir.
So you talk about aversion, and so when you notice that you are aversive to something, and you take a step back and you try to hold on to it, or process how you're related to that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
So how many tries do you give it to the next step? How do you troubleshoot that?
Yes, okay, that's a nice question. So to repeat it for the camera. If working with aversion, if you step back and get a sense of perspective and try to hold it, but it doesn't work right away, you start to have a sense of frustration that you're not seeing through aversion and it's not like falling away. How many tries do you stay at it? Yeah. So it's a good question. And before I answer that, there's also the discernment about, you know, realizing sitting with something and being with it isn't always the right solution. You know, sometimes it's good to get yourself out of a noxious or dangerous situation. You know, to say, you know, I'm not going to talk to you right now. That quality, you know, just to be aware of that we don't want to apply this blindly to everything. You know, but that being said, there's probably about 90% of the time when aversion arises, it can be something that can be really worth working with. Now, depending on the charge of it and also the clarity of mind, it can take a long time to start to see that. Because the aversion, it's like that's kind of like the very tip of the iceberg. That's what the ship is running into, right? But the big mass of the iceberg is down below, and it came off this huge glacier. And so and we have to realize that we're just kind of starting to get a taste of kind of the very tip of this process of ignorance, of really delusion around what we take as being true. So there's a lot of patience that has to come with it. And so a good rule of thumb, again, if it's not something that you really obviously need to avoid, is feeling it, just kind of feeling it with a lot of compassion, a lot of patience, saying, okay, where is this in the body? That's the first step. Okay, you know, I feel this in here. And practice kind of letting go of trying to do something with it, but more just to really feel it, almost welcome it in more fully, which is counterintuitive, right? This is hurting, let's get rid of this, you know. So, okay, let me feel that a little bit more clearly. Be warned that that's going to make it more intense, often, at first at least. You feel the intensity more. But as you feel it, it's like you're feeling it more, instead of feeling it for a long period, you're feeling it for a short period. And then you start to maybe see a little different aspect of it. So let's say it has 100 facets to it. And by doing this, you see one of the facets. And then something softens around it. And then, you know, it comes up again and you relax a little bit more, you see another facet. And once you start to see 100 of those facets, then it starts to fall away. And so that, for some of these things, I mean, from my own experience, some of them, it takes years. And sometimes it just takes a few moments. The good news is once you start to have the process, you start to hold it in this way and start to see it very clearly without any kind of objection to it, then you start to get the knack of it. So you start to see, you don't get so convinced. So usually the bottom line is when you find that you see something and it doesn't immediately release, there's an aspect that's not being seen. There's an aspect that still you're believing in that, you know, may be very hidden, may be very kind of down there. And so you just be patient with it and just so you start to see it more and more clearly. Yes.
Unwholesome leads towards suffering and wholesome leads towards freedom. However, often when I make that choice, I have to choose something that is wholesome but uncomfortable for a while. And especially when it has to do with the self and, you know, my ego. Mm-hmm. And I'm so used to thinking that if it's pleasant and comfortable, you know, for this thing I've been building my whole life, that I'm so, you know, so much, I care so much about it. It's a big choice, and I catch myself a lot, kind of going away sometimes from the wholesome if I don't really think about it. because it often feels unpleasant and uncomfortable and threatening. And so I have to keep, and I'm suffering often, but because I haven't really discerned that that suffering is really leading away from freedom, you know, because that suffering is often threatening to my ego or something like
yes,
that.
Yes, yes.
And so it's really a hard discernment sometimes is what I'm saying. I get confused and I think something's, you know, I'm really going in the wrong direction because it's so hard or it's so threatening or it's seems like it's going away from everything I've been working towards.
Yeah.
So the way you have described it and kind of like the signposts are wholesome, unwholesome, freedom, continued suffering, and the holding on to self. It seems like those are really good signposts to help clarify this discernment process.
Yes.
So I appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you. So just to paraphrase that, summarize, there's a sense of being very clear about when something's pleasant or unpleasant. But the quality of what it gets confusing is the wholesome and unwholesome, especially when something is wholesome but unpleasant. Yeah, especially when it's really threatening to kind of what you've invested in, what you've really put your hopes and dreams around. And when that gets challenged, it doesn't feel very pleasant. And so it gets confusing about, because we're so trained to find, okay, go toward what's pleasant, go away from unpleasant. I mean, that's really in our DNA to do that. And so the discernment comes in to start to see that the wholesomeness may not always be pleasant, right? Because especially if it's challenging. Now that's a really interesting piece too, because I would look a little closer at that. You know, maybe we can talk more about that sense of things being really painful and difficult. Because sometimes we kind of have this sense of this idea of what's really wise effort, but if we look at it a little closer, it has a little bit of distortion in it. And sometimes it just takes a little bit of distortion and wise effort to cause a whole lot of suffering. That, you know, our effort is like, I mean, like from my own practice, you can say, okay, relaxing with this moment experience, that sounds pretty wholesome, right? But I would hold that so strongly that I would be basically torturing my body by trying to sit still, right? And he goes, okay, just relax with it, just relax with it. And it's like, how about you just stretch your leg out? And then you won't hurt, and then you can actually have a different capacity of mindfulness, right? And so it took me a long time to realize that, you know, to realize that we can't always, the sense of dis-ease and a sense of friction with what we're exploring or working with, let's see how to say this. Times when I've really worked with a very painful quality, you know, emotionally charged, very, very strong meaning, I would work with it, trying to be present with it, trying to turn toward it, and be, you know, very painful. And at some point, I would realize that very way I was looking with it was still in opposition to it. It was still creating a quality of friction with it. And that kind of magnified the pain of that. And so the learning was really cleaning up that wise effort in itself, that inclination to turning towards something. Because on the other hand, when I'm opening something that's painful, and it's really the wise effort is really in place because of different conditions or the charge or how much I've explored this particular thing, I touch the pain, but it's held in a very different quality. It's like it's held in a sense of it's starting to evaporate, like putting water on a hot grill. It's painful, but it's evaporating, and I can feel the emptiness happening as I'm touching the painfulness. The emptiness and the pain are seen together. I see that's a pathway. If that sense of emptiness is not seen with the pain, then it's like the pain is kind of seeing itself. So that's a more subtle answer to that subtle question. But I would look a little bit more at that, because it shouldn't be like, you know, super, super, super hard. We touch, you know, it often, again, there's often just a little bit of, just off a little bit, and that's enough to really kind of, you know, lock up the works a bit. So we can talk more about that, you know, that kind of the specifics and kind of tease that apart. It's supposed to be a path of greater and greater happiness. In the Buddha's time, a prince was commenting that, you know, telling the Buddha that, you know, I can always tell who your disciples are because they're going around with these big smiles on their face. They seem radiant and content. You know, sometimes I watch us in retreats and we maybe have a little bit off the track because, you know, we're like, so, you know, that's always a good thing to check in. And sometimes it's just a little course correction. There's just a way, an assumption that's kind of slipped in. That's why I spent the first 2 weeks looking at how we relate to effort. What's our natural default? Because that may often show up if we're not attending to that. All right, any other comments or questions? Yes, we'll get you next. Yes.
So it's kind of a follow-up question to the first one. The first question was about sort of how many tries.
Yes.
And you talked about being with the different facets.
Yes.
And my question is, if you could comment a little bit more about what I'm doing with those facets. And that somehow sort of dissolves it for me.
Yes, yes.
But I'm wondering if that's creating a sense of self. Like, is that a skillful kind of thing? I find it to be useful.
It does make sense. So, well, let me see. I'll paraphrase it and see if it makes sense to you what I think it makes sense to me. So the working with those different facets of a particular gripping thing, like with the first question, and working the facets often having that quality of connecting with a basic human need, it starts to dissolve it. You just feel a sense of freedom from that. But the question is then, is that just kind of reinforcing the sense of self in a more slippery or subtle way? Yeah. And it's, the thing about the sense of self is that that's kind of our companion for a long time. It's kind of, that's our way of relating to our moment's experience. And we can make that sense of self more and more functional, more and more kind of cleaned up, more conscious. And that can be a nice way of doing that, is saying, okay, I need to kind of befriend this sense of self. And that's another way to frame it, is that we can't go into the sense of non-self and skip over the painfulness of that sense of self. So often spending time really befriending that, kind of normalizing that, saying, you know, it's not, I don't have to judge myself for this basic human need. And a part of softening is that charge around the sense of who you, the kind of painful sense of self, that the contracted sense of self. Now, once you become more and more comfortable with that, okay, I can be, it's okay for me actually to be here, actually, you know, have my emotions, have my thoughts, have my place on the earth, then the sense of self is much easier to just naturally see in perspective. And that's another way to say it. The sense of self will arise at different times, but it just is held in a different perspective. It's not the only game in town. It's more this functionality that comes up. So I think it sounds skillful. And again, noticing that sense of release, that gives you this clue that it's going toward a quality of freedom. You know, it may not be going toward the absolute freedom in a rocket ship way, but it's like it's going in the right direction and it's going at what's exactly appropriate. And then you still have your question or comment?
Sometimes I struggle with when I'm trying to discern or sit with an uncomfortable situation, say being unskillful, the difference between sort of losing the self and taking responsibility or being accountable. I'm really working on letting go of shaming myself when I discern that I've been unskillful.
Yes.
But then I don't want to let go of, remorse or, when do you apologize? I struggle with that. I think it's actually helpful for me to not sometimes apologize, but more note that I was really unskillful, but not sit in shame around it, and just try harder and express my honest intent to do that without how that sense of not self, that's where that comes from. I just sort of feel like I'm letting go of this attachment to this identity that I'm a bad person when I do these things. And so then it actually feels really wise to not dwell in that shame. But then I want to live my life in a way that doesn't go against a culture where people need an apology or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do. I do. I think I do. let me paraphrase that. So the sense of, noticing when one is unskillful, and on one hand, realizing this sense of not needing to be ashamed of that, not to go in that sense of guilt around and shame around that action, but also realizing that shame kind of helped you be more like taking responsibility and apologizing. And so it's kind of this confusion about, okay, if there's not the sense of self that to be ashamed of, there's a freedom from that. That feels really good. But I don't want to lose the capacity to be socially appropriate and to own up to my mistakes. And how does that kind of fit into this? Yeah. And so say this in a lot of these questions, they're coming from the place of the self trying to understand the self. And so it's the self wants to do that. I mean, that's what we, how else are we going to look through our sense of self? But so that's why it makes it so tricky, is we have to start to see beyond that essential perspective. So once that becomes more and more seen, a lot of these questions make more, it's like, okay, there's not a conflict with that. Now the sense of shame though, it's very similar to the last question. That's kind of that really hardened quality of selfing that's very painful, often very engendered from young age. And learning to not believe that, not to have to do that, it's very liberating. It makes the sense of self much more at ease. There's a quiet that comes from that. And from that quiet, then there can be even a deeper releasing. Now, from my own experience, when I don't take things so personally, it's not about me being a bad boy or being, not lovable, all those kind of archaic pieces, I actually find I'm able to take responsibility much more easily and say, you know, I was not skillful there. I can see how that hurt you. I can see how that wasn't the best thing. And this is what I want to do for that. It allows me to actually show up much more because I'm not imploding in that sense of being embarrassed and want to crawl under a hole. It actually allows me to be much more engaged with that.
You're not ashamed.
And, yeah, exactly.
What happened is you're more able to talk about it in an almost
yes.
mutual
way. Yes, exactly. You're not ashamed of what happened. You're able to talk about it in a mutual way. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And you can actually have a much better connection. Have you ever tried to make contact with someone who's caught in their shame? It's like you can't reach them. They're just imploding. It's like a black hole. It's like, come out of there. And you can't quite connect with them because they're believing everything you say just goes back into that. But when someone's not like that, they can actually meet you as a human being. Like, yeah, I messed up. It's like, yeah, that hurt. I'm sorry. Let's try not to do that again. And so that's really some of the benefits of loosening this sense of self, especially these really painful processes. And that sense of self even seen through even more and more, there's just more of a capacity to be fluid and to meet people. And of course we realize we make mistakes, we err, we cause damage, and we own up to it. All right, so let's call that good because we have some announcements from Rob here. And...